This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Likeness by Tana French. Read for you by Heather O'Neill.
Prologue. Some nights, if I'm sleeping on my own, I still dream about Whitethorn House. In the dream, it's always spring. Cool, fine light with a late afternoon haze. I climb the worn stone steps and knock on the door, that great brass knocker, going black with age and heavy enough to startle you every time. And an old woman with an apron and a deft, uncompromising face lets me in. Then she hangs the big rusted key back in her belt and walks away down the drive, under the falling cherry blossom, and I close the door behind her. The house is always empty. The bedrooms are bare and bright, only my footsteps echoing off the floorboards, circling up through the sun and the dust motes to the high ceilings. Smell of wild hyacinths, drifting through the wide-open windows, and of beeswax polish. Chips of white paint flaking off the window sashes, and a tendril of ivy swaying in over the sill. Wood doves, lazy somewhere outside. In the sitting room the piano is open, wood glowing chestnut and almost too bright to look at in the bars of sun. The breeze stirring the yellowed sheet music like a finger. The table is laid ready for us. 5 settings. The bone china plates and the long-stemmed wine glasses. Fresh-cut honeysuckle trailing from a crystal bowl. But the silverware has gone dim with tarnish, and the heavy damask napkins are frilled with dust. Daniel's cigarette case lies by his place at the head of the table, open and empty except for a burnt-down match. Somewhere in the house, faint as a fingernail flick at the edge of my hearing, there are sounds. A scuffle. Whispers. It almost stops my heart. The others aren't gone. I got it all wrong somehow. They're only hiding. They're still here, forever and ever. I follow the tiny noises through the house room by room, stopping at every step to listen. But I'm never quick enough. They slide away like mirages, always just behind that door, or up those stairs. The tip of a giggle, instantly muffled. A creak of wood. I leave wardrobe doors swinging open. I take the steps 3 at a time. I swing round the newel post at the top and catch a flash of movement in the corner of my eye. The spotted old mirror at the end of the corridor. My face reflected in it, laughing. Chapter 1. This is Lexi Madison's story, not mine. I'd love to tell you one without getting into the other, but it doesn't work that way. I used to think I sewed us together at the edges with my own hands, pulled the stitches tight, and I could unpick them any time I wanted. Now I think it always ran deeper than that, and farther, underground, out of sight and way beyond my control. This much is mine, though. Everything I did. Frank puts it all down to the others. Mainly to Daniel. While as far as I can tell, Sam thinks that, in some obscure and slightly bizarro way, it was Lexi's fault. When I say it wasn't like that, they give me careful sideways looks and change the subject. I get the feeling Frank thinks I have some creepy variant of Stockholm Syndrome. That does happen to undercover sometimes. But not this time. I'm not trying to protect anyone. There's no one left to protect. Lexi and the others will never know they're taking the blame, and wouldn't care if they did. But give me more credit than that. Someone else may have dealt the hand, but I picked it up off the table. I played every card, and I had my reasons. This is the main thing you need to know about Alexandra Madison. She never existed. Frank Mackey and I invented her a long time ago, on a bright summer afternoon in his dusty office on Harcourt Street. He wanted people to infiltrate a drug ring in University College Dublin. I wanted the job, maybe more than I had ever wanted anything in my life. He was a legend. Frank Mackey, still in his 30s and already running undercover operations. The best undercover agent Ireland's ever had, people said. Reckless and fearless. A tightrope artist with no net, ever. He walked into IRA cells and criminal gangs like he was walking into his local pub. Everyone had told me the story, when the Snake, a career gangster and five-star wacko, who once left one of his own men quadriplegic for not buying his round, got suspicious and threatened to use a nail gun on Frank's hands. Frank looked him in the eye without breaking a sweat, and bluffed him down till the Snake slapped him on the back and gave him a fake Rolex by way of apology. Frank still wears it. I was a shiny green rookie, only a year out of Templemore Training College. A couple of days earlier, when Frank had sent out the call for cops who had a college education and could pass for early 20s, I had been wearing a neon yellow vest that was too big for me and patrolling a small town in Sligo, where most of the locals looked disturbingly alike. I should have been nervous of him, but I wasn't. Not at all. I wanted the assignment too badly to have room for anything else. His office door was open, and he was sitting on the edge of his desk, wearing jeans and a faded blue t-shirt, flipping through my file. The office was small and had a disheveled look, like he used it mainly for storage. The desk was empty, not even a family photo. On the shelves, paperwork was mixed with blue CDs, tabloids, a poker set, and a woman's pink cardigan with the tag still on. I decided I liked this guy.
Cassandra Maddox, he said, glancing up.
Yes, sir, I said. He was average height, stocky but fit, with good shoulders and close-cut brown hair. I'd been expecting someone so nondescript he was practically invisible, maybe the cancer man from the X-Files. But this guy had rough, blunt features and wide blue eyes, and the kind of presence that leaves heat streaks on the air where he's been. He wasn't my type, but I was pretty sure he got a lot of female attention.
Frank.
Sir is for desk jockeys. His accent was old inner-city Dublin, subtle but deliberate, like a challenge. He slid off the desk and held out his hand. Cassie, I said, shaking it. He pointed at a chair and went back to his perch on the desk.
Says here, he said, tapping my file. You're good under pressure.
It took me a second to figure out what he was talking about. Back when I was a trainee posted to a scuzzy part of Cork City, I had talked down a panicked teenage schizophrenic who was threatening to cut his own throat with his grandfather's straight razor. I had almost forgotten about that. It hadn't occurred to me till then that this was probably why I was up for this job.
I hope so, I said. You're what? 27?
26. The light through the window was on my face, and he gave me a long, considering look.
You can do 21, no problem. Says here you have 3 years of college. Where?
Trinity. Psychology. His eyebrows shot up, mock impressed.
Ah, a professional. Why didn't you finish?
I developed an unknown-to-science allergy to Anglo-Irish accents, I told him. He liked that.
UCD going to bring you out in a rash.
I'll take my antihistamines. Frank hopped off his desk and went to the window, motioning me to follow.
Okay, he said. See that couple down there?
A guy and a girl walking up the street, talking. She found keys and let them into a depressing apartment block.
Tell me about them, Frank said.
He leaned back against the window and hooked his thumbs in his belt, watching me. They're students, I said. Book bags. They'd been food shopping. The carrier bags from Dunn's. She's better off than he is. Her jacket was expensive. But he had a patch on his jeans and not in a trendy way.
They a couple? Friends? Flatmates?
A couple. They walked closer than friends. Tilted their heads closer.
They're going out long.
I like this, the new way my mind was working.
A while, yeah, I said.
Frank cocked an eyebrow like a question, and for a moment I wasn't sure how I knew. Then it clicked. They didn't look at each other when they were talking. New couples look at each other all the time. Established ones don't need to check in as often.
Living together,
No. Or he'd have automatically gone for his keys as well. That's her place. She has at least one flatmate, though. They both looked up at a window, checking to see if the curtains were open. How's their relationship? Good. She made him laugh. Guys mostly don't laugh at a girl's jokes unless they're still at the chat-up stage. He was carrying both the Dunn's bags, and she held the door open for him before she went in. They look after each other. Frank gave me a nod. Nicely done. Undercover's half intuition. And I don't mean psychic shite. I mean noticing things and analysing them before you even know you're doing it. The rest is speed and balls. If you're going to say something or do something, you do it fast, and you do it with total conviction. If you stop to second guess yourself, you're fucked, possibly dead. You'll be out of touch a lot the next year or two. Got family? An aunt and an uncle, I said. Boyfriend? Yes. You'll be able to contact them, but they won't be able to contact you. They going to be okay with that? They'll have to be, I said. He was still slouching easily against the window frame, but I caught the sharp glint of blue. He was watching me hard. This isn't some Colombian cartel we're talking about, and you'll be dealing mostly with the lowest ranks, at first, anyway. But you've got to know this job isn't safe. Half these people are binned out of their heads most of the time, and the other half are very serious about what they do, which means none of them would have a problem with the idea of killing you. That make you nervous? No, I said, and I meant it. Not at all. Lovely, said Frank. Let's get coffee and get to work. It took me a minute to realize that that was it. I was in. I'd been expecting a 3-hour interview and a stack of weird tests with ink blots and questions about my mother. But Frank doesn't work like that. I still don't know where, along the way, he made the decision. For a long time, I waited for the right moment to ask him. Now I'm not sure anymore whether I want to know what he saw in me. What it was that told him I would be good at this. We got burnt-tasting coffee and a packet of chocolate biscuits from the canteen, and spent the rest of the day coming up with Alexandra Madison. I picked the name. You'll remember it better that way, Frank said. Madison, because it sounds enough like my own surname to make me turn around. And Lexi, because when I was a kid, that was the name of my imaginary sister. Frank found a big sheet of paper and drew a timeline of her life for me. You were born in Hollis Street Hospital on the 1st of March, 1979. Father, Sean Madison, a minor diplomat, posted in Canada. That's so we can pull you out fast if we need to. Give you a family emergency and off you go. It also means you can spend your childhood traveling, to explain why nobody knows you. Ireland is small. Everyone's cousin's girlfriend went to school with you. We could make you foreign, but I don't want you fucking about with an accent. Mother? Carolyn Kelly Madison. She got a job. She's a nurse. Careful, think faster. Keep an eye out for implications. Nurses need a new license for every country. She trained, but she quit working when you were 7 and your family left Ireland. Want brothers and sisters? Sure, why not? I said. I'll have a brother. There was something intoxicating about this. I kept wanting to laugh, just at the lavish, giddy freedom of it. Relatives and countries and possibilities spread out in front of me, and I could pick whatever I wanted. I could grow up in a palace in Bhutan with 17 brothers and sisters and a personal chauffeur if I felt like it. I shoved another biscuit into my mouth before Frank could see me smiling and think I wasn't taking this seriously. Whatever your heart desires. He's 6 years younger, so he's in Canada with your parents. What's his name? Stephen. Imaginary brother. I had an active fantasy life as a kid. Do you get on with him? What's he like? Faster, Frank said when I took a breath. He's a little smart arse, football mad, he fights with our parents all the time because he's 15, but he still talks to me. Sun slanting across the scarred wood of the desk, Frank smelled clean, like soap and leather. He was a good teacher, a wonderful teacher. His black biro scribbled in dates and places and events, and Lexi Madison developed out of nothing like a Polaroid. She curled off the page and hung in the air like incense smoke. A girl with my face and a life from a half-forgotten dream. When did you have your first boyfriend? Where were you living? What was his name? Who dumped who? Why? Frank found an ashtray, flipped the players out of his packet for me. When the sun bar slid off the desk and the sky started to dim outside the window, he spun his chair around, took a bottle of whiskey off a shelf, and spiked our coffees. We've earned it, he said. Cheers. We made her a restless one, Lexi, bright and educated, a good girl all her life, but brought up without the habit of settling and never learned the knack. A little naive, maybe, a little unguarded, too ready to tell you anything you asked without thinking twice. She's bait, Frank said bluntly, and she has to be the right bait to make the dealers rise. We need her innocent enough that they won't consider her a threat, respectable enough to be useful to them, and rebellious enough that they won't wonder why she wants to play. By the time we finished, it was dark. Nice work, Frank said, folding up the timeline and passed it to me. There's a detective training course starting in 10 days. I'll get you into that. Then you'll come back here, and I'll work with you for a while. When UCD starts back in October, you'll go in. He hooked the leather jacket off the corner of the shelves, switched off the light, and shut the door in the dark little office. I walked back to the bus station dazzled, wrapped in magic, floating in the middle of a secret and a brand new world, with the timeline making little crackling sounds in the pocket of my uniform jacket. It was that quick, and it felt that simple. I'm not going to get into the long, snarled chain of events that took me from undercover to domestic violence. The abridged version? UCD's premier speed freak got paranoid and stabbed me. Wounded in the line of duty got me a place on the murder squad. The murder squad got to be a head wrecker. I got out. It had been years since I'd thought about Lexi and her short, shadowy life. I'm not the type to look back over my shoulder. Or at least, I try hard not to be. Gone is gone. Pretending anything else is a waste of time. But now, I think I always knew there would be consequences to Lexi Madison. You can't make a person, a human being with a first kiss and a sense of humor and a favorite sandwich, and then expect her to dissolve back into scribbled notes and whiskey coffee when she no longer suits your purposes. I think I always knew she would come back to find me, someday. It took her 4 years. She picked her moment carefully. When she came knocking, it was an early morning in April, a few months after the end of my time in murder, and I was at the firing range. The range we use is underground in the city centre, deep under half the cars in Dublin, and a thick layer of smog. I didn't need to be there. I've always been a good shot, and my next qualifying test wasn't for months. But for the last while, I had been waking up way too early for work, and way too restless for anything else. And target practice was the only thing I had found that worked the jitters out of me. I took my time adjusting the earmuffs and checking my gun. Waited till everyone else was concentrating on their own targets, so they wouldn't see me galvanizing like an electrocuted cartoon character on the first few shots. Being easily freaked out comes with its own special skill set. You develop subtle tricks to work around it. Make sure people don't notice. Pretty soon, if you're a fast learner, you can get through the day looking almost exactly like a normal human being. I never used to be like that. I always figured nerves were for Jane Austen characters and helium-voiced girls who never buy their round. I would no more have turned shaky in a crisis than I would have carried smelling salts around in my reticule. Getting stabbed by the drug demon of UCD barely even fazed me. The department shrink spent weeks trying to convince me I was deeply traumatized. But eventually, he had to give up. Admit I was fine, sort of regretfully. He doesn't get a lot of stabbed cops to play with. I think he was hoping I would have some kind of fancy complex. And let me go back to work. Embarrassingly, the one that got me wasn't a spectacular mass murder, or a hostage crisis gone bad, or a nice quiet guy with human organs in his Tupperware. My last case in murder was such a simple one. So much like dozens of others. Nothing to warn us. Just a little girl dead on a summer morning, and my partner and me goofing off in the squad room when the call came in. From outside, it even went well. Officially, we got a solve in barely a month. Society was saved from the evildoer. It looked all pretty in the media and in the end-of-year stats. There was no dramatic car chase. No shootout. Nothing like that. I was the one who came off worst. Physically anyway. And all I had was a couple of scratches on my face. They didn't even leave scars. Such a happy ending all round. Underneath, though. Operation Vestal. Say it to one of the murder squad, even now. Even one of the guys who don't know the whole story. And you'll get that instant look. Hands and eyebrows going up meaningfully as he distances himself from the clusterfuck and the collateral damage. In every way that mattered, we lost, and we lost big. Some people are little Chernobyls, shimmering with silence spreading poison. Get anywhere near them, and every breath you take will wreck you from the inside out. Some cases, ask any cop, are malignant and incurable, devouring everything they touch. I came out with a variety of symptoms that would have made the shrink bounce up and down in his little leather sandals. Except that mercifully it didn't occur to anyone to send me to the shrink for a scratched face. It was your standard issue trauma stuff. Shaken, not eaten, sticking to the ceiling every time the doorbell or the phone rang. With a few ornamentations of my own. My coordination went funny. For the first time in my life I was tripping on my own feet. Bumping into door jams, bonking my head off cupboards, and I stopped dreaming. Before, I had always dreamed in great wild streams of images, pillars of fire spinning across dark mountains, vines exploding through solid brick, deer leaping down Sandy Mount Beach wrapped in ropes of light. Afterwards, I got thick black sleep that hit me like a mallet the second my head touched the pillow. Sam, my boyfriend, although that idea still startled me sometimes, said to give it time. It would all wear off. When I told him I wasn't so sure, he nodded peacefully and said that would wear off too. Every now and then Sam got right up my nose. I considered the traditional cop solution, booze, early and often, but I was scared I would end up phoning inappropriate people at 3 in the morning to spill my guts. Plus, I discovered the target practice anesthetized me almost as well and without any messy side effects. This made almost no sense, given the way I was reacting to loud noises in general. But I was okay with that. After the first few shots, a fuse would blow in the back of my brain and the rest of the world vanished somewhere faint and far away. My hands turned rock steady on the gun, and it was just me and the paper target. The hard, familiar smell of powder in the air, and my back braced solid against the recoil. I came out calm and numb as if I'd been valiumed. By the time the effect wore off, I had made it through another day at work, and I could go whack my head off sharp corners in the comfort of my own home. I'd got to the point where I could make 9 headshots out of 10, at 40 yards, and the wizened little man who ran the range had started looking at me with a horse trainer's eye. And making noises about the department championships. I finished up around 7 that morning. I was in the locker room cleaning my gun and trying to shoot the breeze with 2 guys from Vice without giving them the impression that I wanted to go get breakfast, when my mobile phone rang.
Jesus,
one of the Vice boys said.
You're DV, aren't you? Who has the energy to beat up his missus at this hour?
You can always make time for the things that really matter, I said. Digging my locker key out of my pocket.
Maybe it's Black Ops, said the younger guy, grinning at me, looking for sharp shooters.
He was big and red-headed, and he thought I was cute. He had his muscles arranged to full advantage, and I had caught him checking out my ring finger.
Must have heard we weren't available, said his mate.
I fished the phone out of my locker. The screen said, Sam O'Neill. And the missed call icon was flashing at me in one corner. Hi, I said. What's up? Cassie, Sam said. He sounded terrible, breathless and sick, as if someone had punched the wind out of him. Are you okay? I turned my shoulder to the vice guys and moved off into a corner. I'm fine. Why? What's wrong?
Jesus Christ, Sam said.
He made a hard little noise like his throat was too tight.
I called you 4 times. I was about to send someone over to your place looking for you. Why didn't you answer your bloody phone?
This was not like Sam. He's the gentlest guy I've ever known. I'm at the firing range, I said. It was in my locker. What's happened?
Sorry, I didn't mean to. Sorry.
He made that harsh little sound again.
I got called out on a case.
My heart gave one huge whap against my ribcage. Sam is on the murder squad. I knew I should probably sit down for this, but I couldn't make my knees bend. I leaned back against the lockers instead. Who is it? I asked.
What? No, God, it's... No, it's not... I mean, it's not anyone we know or... Anyway, I don't think... Listen, can you come down here?
My breath came back. Sam, I said, what the hell is going on?
Just, can you just come? We're in Wicklow, outside Glenskeighy. You know it, right? If you follow the signs, go through Glenskeighy village and keep going straight south. About 3/4 of a mile on, there's a little lane to your right. You'll see the crime scene tape. We'll meet you there.
The vice boys were starting to look interested. My shift starts in an hour, I said. It'll take me that long just to get out there.
I'll call it in. I'll tell DV we need you.
You don't. I'm not in murder anymore, Sam. If this is a murder case, it's nothing to do with me. A guy's voice in the background. A firm, easy drawl, hard to ignore. Familiar. But I couldn't place it.
Hang on, Sam said.
I clamped the phone between my ear and my shoulder and started fitting my gun back together. If it wasn't someone we knew, then it had to be a bad one. To make Sam sound like that? Very bad. Irish homicides are still mostly simple things. Drug fights, burglaries gone wrong, SOS killings, spouse on spouse, or, depending who you ask, same old shite. This elaborate family feud in Limerick that's been screwing up the figures for decades. We've never had the orgies of nightmare that other countries get. The serial killers, the ornate tortures, the basements lined with bodies thick as autumn leaves. But it's only a matter of time now. For 10 years, Dublin's been changing faster than our minds can handle. The economic boom has given us too many people with helicopters and too many crushed into cockroachy flats from hell. Way too many loathing their lives in fluorescent cubicles, enduring for the weekend, and then starting all over again. And we're fracturing under the weight of it. By the end of my stint in murder, I could feel it coming. Felt the high sing of madness in the air. The city, hunching and twitching like a rabid dog building towards the rampage. Sooner or later, someone had to pull the first horror case. We don't have official profilers, but the murder guys, who mostly didn't go to college and who were more impressed by my psychology semi-degree than they should have been, used to use me. I was okay at it. I read textbooks and statistics a lot, in my spare time, trying to catch up. Sam's cop instincts would have overridden his protective ones, and he would have called me in, if he needed to, if he'd got to a scene and found something bad enough.
Hang on! The redhead said.
He had switched out of display mode and was sitting up straight on his bench.
You used to be in murder.
This right here was exactly why I hadn't wanted to get chummy. I had heard that avid note way too many times over the past few months. Once upon a time, I said, giving him my sweetest smile and my you do not want to go there look. Redzer's curiosity and his libido had a quick duel. apparently he'd figured out that his libido's chances were slim to none anyway, because the curiosity won.
You're the one who worked that case, right?
He said, sliding a few lockers closer.
The dead kid. What's the real story?
All the rumors are true, I told him.
On the other end of the phone, Sam was having a muffled argument, short, frustrated questions cut off by that easy draw. And I knew that if the redhead would just shut up for a second, I could work out who it was.
I heard your partner went mental and shagged a suspect,
Redzer informed me, helpfully. I wouldn't know, I said, trying to disentangle myself from my bulletproof vest without losing the phone. My first instinct was, still, to tell him to do something creative to himself. But neither my ex-partner's mental status nor his love life was my problem. Not anymore. Sam came back on the phone sounding even more tense and rattled.
Can you wear sunglasses and a hood or a hat or something?
I stopped with my vest half over my head.
What the hell?
Please, Cassie, Sam said, and he sounded strained to breaking point.
Please.
I drive an ancient Bacardi Vespa, which is like totally uncool in a town where you are what you spend, but which has its uses. In city traffic, it moves about 4 times as fast as your average SUV. I can actually park it, and it provides a handy social shortcut, in that anyone who gives it a snotty look is probably not going to be my new best friend. Once I got out of the city, it was perfect bike weather. It had rained during the night, furious sleety rain slapping at my window, but that had blown itself out by dawn, and the day was sharp and blue, the first of almost spring. Other years, on mornings like this one, I used to drive out into the countryside and sing at the top of my lungs into the wind at the edge of the speed limit. Glenskeaghy is outside Dublin, tucked away in the Wicklow Mountains near nothing very much. I'd lived half my life in Wicklow without getting any closer to it than the odd signpost. It turned out to be that kind of place, a scatter of houses getting old around a once-a-month church and a pub and a sell-everything shop, small and isolated enough to have been overlooked even by the desperate generation trawling the countryside for homes they can afford. 8 o'clock on a Thursday morning, and the main street, to use both words loosely, was postcard perfect and empty. Just one old woman pulling a shopping cart past a worn granite monument to something or other. Little sugared almond houses lined up crookedly behind her, and the hills rising green and brown and indifferent over it all. I could imagine someone getting killed there, but a farmer in a generations-old fight over a boundary fence, a woman whose man had turned savage with drink and cabin fever, a man sharing a house with his brother 40 years too long, deep-rooted, familiar crimes old as Ireland, nothing to make a detective as experienced as Sam sound like that. And that other voice on the phone was nagging at me. Sam is the only detective I know who doesn't have a partner. He likes flying solo, working every case with a new team, local uniforms who want a hand from an expert, pairs from the murder squad who need a third man on a big case. Sam can get along with anyone. He's the perfect backup man. And I wished I knew which of the people I used to work with he was backing up this time. Outside the village, the road narrowed, twisting upwards among bright gorse bushes, and the fields got smaller and rockier. There were 2 men standing on the crest of the hill. Sam, fair and sturdy and tense, feet planted apart and hands in his jacket pockets. And a few feet from him, someone else, head up, leaning back against the stiff wind. The sun was still low in the sky, and their long shadows turned them giant and portentous, silhouetted almost too bright to look at against skimming clouds, like 2 messengers walking out of the sun and down the shimmering road. Behind them, crime scene tape fluttered and whipped. Sam raised his hand when I waved. The other guy cocked his head sideways, one fast tilt like a wink, and I knew who it was.
Fuck me briefly,
I said, before I was even off the Vespa. It's Frankie. Where did you come from?
Frank grabbed me off the ground in a one-armed hug. 4 years hadn't managed to change him one bit. I was pretty sure he was even wearing the same banged-up leather jacket.
Cassie Maddox, he said. World's best fake student. How've you been? What's all this about DV?
I'm saving the world. They gave me a lightsaber and all. I caught Sam's confused frown out of the corner of my eye. I don't talk much about undercover. I'm not sure he'd ever heard me mention Frank's name. But it was only when I turned to him that I realized he looked awful. White around the mouth and his eyes too wide. Something inside me clenched. A bad one. How you doing? I asked him, pulling off my helmet.
Grand,
Sam said. He tried to smile at me, but it came out lopsided.
Ooh,
Frank said, mock camp, holding me at arm's length and eyeballing me.
Check you out. Is this what the well-dressed detective is wearing these days?
The last time he had seen me, I'd been in combats on a top that said, Miss Kitty's House of Fun wants you.
Bite me, Frank, I told him. At least I've changed my gear once or twice in the last few years.
No, 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 I'm impressed. Very executive. He tried to spin me round. I batted his hand away. Just for the record, I was not dressed like Hillary Clinton here. I was wearing my work clothes. Black trouser suit, white shirt, and I wasn't that crazy about them myself. But when I switched to domestic violence, my new superintendent kept going on at me about the importance of projecting an appropriate corporate image and building public confidence, which apparently cannot be done in jeans and a t-shirt, and I didn't have the energy to resist.
Bring sunglasses and a hoodie or something, Frank asked. They'll go great with this get-up.
You brought me down here to discuss my fashion sense, I inquired. I found an ancient red beret in my satchel and waved it at him.
Nah, we'll get back to that some other time. Here, have these.
Frank pulled sunglasses out of his pocket, repulsive mirrored things that belonged on Don Johnson in 1985, and passed them to me. If I'm going to go around looking like that much of a dork, I said, eyeing them, there had better be a damn good explanation.
We'll get to that. If you don't like those, you can always wear your helmet.
Frank waited till I shrugged and put on the dork gear. The buzz of seeing him had dissolved and my back was tensing up again. Sam looking sick, Frank on the case, and not wanting me spotted at the scene. It read a lot like an undercover had got killed.
Gorgeous as always, Frank said.
He held the crime scene tape for me to duck under, and it was so familiar. I had made that quick, easy movement so many times. But for a split second, it felt like coming home. I automatically settled my gun at my belt and glanced over my shoulder for my partner, as if this was my own case I were coming to, before I remembered.
Here's the story, Sam said. At about 6:15 this morning, a local fella called Richard Doyle was walking his dog along this lane. He let it off the lead to have a run about in the fields. There's a ruined house not far off the lane, and the dog went in and wouldn't come out. In the end, Doyle had to go after it. He found the dog sniffing around the body of a woman. Doyle grabbed the dog, legged it out of there and rang the uniforms.
I relaxed a little. I didn't know any other women from undercover. And I'm here, why? I asked. Not to mention you, Sunshine. Did you transfer into murder and no one told me?
You'll see, Frank said.
I was following him down the lane and I could only see the back of his head.
Believe me, you'll see.
I glanced over my shoulder at Sam.
Nothing to worry about, he said, quietly.
He was getting his color back, in bright, uneven splotches.
You'll be grand.
The lane sloped upwards, too narrow for two people to walk abreast. Just a muddy track with ragged hawthorn hedges spilling in on both sides. Where they broke, the hillside was crazy quilted into green fields scattered with sheep. A brand new lamb was bleating somewhere, far off,
The air was cold and rich enough to drink, and the sun sifted long and gold through the hawthorn. I considered just keeping on walking, over the brow of the hill and on, letting Sam and Frank deal with whatever seething dark blotch was waiting for us under the morning.
"Here we go," Frank said.
The hedge fell away to a broken-down stone wall bordering a field left to run wild. The house was 30 or 40 yards off the lane, one of the famine cottages that still litter Ireland, emptied in the 19th century by death or immigration and never reclaimed. One look added another layer to my feeling that I wanted to be very far away from whatever was going on here. The whole field should have been alive with focused, unhurried movement. Uniforms working their way across the grass with their heads bent. Technical bureau crew in white coveralls busy with cameras and rulers and print dust. More guys unloading their stretcher. Instead, there were two uniforms, shifting from foot to foot on either side of the cottage door, and looking slightly out of their depth, and a pair of pissed-off robins bouncing around the eaves making outraged noises. "Where is everyone?" I asked. I was talking to Sam, but Frank said,
"Cooper's been and gone."
Cooper is the state pathologist.
"I figured he needed to have a look at her as fast as possible, for time of death. The bureau can wait. Forensic evidence isn't going anywhere."
"Jesus," I said.
"It is if we walk on it.
Sam, ever worked a double homicide before?" Frank raised an eyebrow.
"Got another body?" "Yours, once the bureau get here. 6 people wandering all over a crime scene before they've cleared it. They're gonna kill you."
"Worth it," Frank said cheerfully, swinging a leg over the wall. "I wanted to keep this under wraps for a little while, and that's hard to do if you've got bureau guys swarming all over the place. People tend to notice them." Something was badly wrong here. This was Sam's case, not Frank's. Sam should have been the one deciding how the evidence was handled and who got called in when. Whatever was in that cottage, it had shaken him up enough that he had let Frank sweep in, bulldoze him out of the way, and instantly, efficiently start arranging this case to suit whatever agenda he had today. I tried to catch Sam's eye, but he was pulling himself over the wall and not looking at either of us.
"Can you climb walls in that get-up?" Frank inquired sweetly. "Or would you like a hand?"
I made a face at him, and vaulted into the field, up to my ankles in long wet grass and dandelions. The cottage had been 2 rooms once a long time ago. One of them still looked more or less intact. It even had most of its roof. But the other one was just shards of wall and windows onto open air. Bindweed and moss and little trailing blue flowers had rooted in the cracks. Someone had spray-painted Shaz beside the doorway. Not very artistically. But the house was too inconvenient for a regular hangout. Even prowling teenagers had mostly left it alone, to collapse on itself in its own slow time.
"Detective Cassie Maddox," Frank said. "Sergeant Noel Byrne and Garda Joe Doherty, Rathowen Station. Glensky, he's on their patch."
"For our sins," said Byrne.
He sounded like he meant it.
He was somewhere in his 50s with a slumped back and watery blue eyes, and he smelled of wet uniform and loser.
Doherty was a gangly kid with unfortunate ears, and when I held out my hand to him, he did a double take straight out of a cartoon. I could practically hear the boing of his eyeballs snapping back into place. God only knew what he had heard about me. Cops have a better rumor mill than any bingo club. But I didn't have time to worry about it right then. I gave him the smile and stare number, and he mumbled something and dropped my hand as if it had scorched him.
"We'd like Detective Maddox to take a look at our body," Frank said.
"I'd say you would, all right," said Byrne, eyeing me.
I wasn't sure he meant it the way it sounded. He didn't look like he had the energy. Doherty snickered nervously.
"Ready?"
Sam asked me quietly.
"The suspense is killing me," I said.
It came out a little snottier than I intended. Frank was already ducking into the cottage and pulling aside the long sprays of trailing bramble that curtained the doorway to the inner room.
"Ladies first," he said with a flourish.
I hung the stud muffin glasses off the front of my shirt by one earpiece, took a breath, and went in. It should have been a peaceful, sad little room. Long bands of sun slanting through holes in the roof and filtering past the net of branches over the windows. Shivering like light on water. Some family's hearth, cold 100 years, with piles of birds' nests falling down the chimney and the rusty iron hook for the cooking pot still hanging ready. A wood dove, murmuring contentedly, somewhere nearby. But if you've seen a dead body, you know how they change the air. That huge silence. The absence strong as a black hole. Time stopped, and molecules frozen around the still thing that's learned the final secret. The one he can never tell. Most dead people are the only thing in the room. Murder victims are different. They don't come alone. The silence rises up to a deafening shout, and the air is streaked and hand-printed. The body smokes with the brand of that other person grabbing you just as hard. The killer. The first thing that hit me about this scene, though, was how slight a mark the killer had left. I had been bracing myself against things I didn't want to imagine. Naked and spread-eagled, vicious dark wounds too thick to count, body parts scattered in corners. But this girl looked as if she had arranged herself carefully on the floor and let out her last breath in a long, even sigh, chosen her own time and place with no need for anyone's help along the way. She was lying on her back, among the shadows in front of the fireplace, neatly, with her feet together and her arms at her sides. She was wearing a navy pea coat, fallen open. Under it were indigo jeans, pulled up and zipped, runners and a blue top with a dark star tie-dyed across the front. The only thing out of the ordinary was her hands, clenched into tight fists. Frank and Sam had moved in beside me, and I shot Frank a puzzled look. And the big deal is? But he just watched me, his face giving away nothing. She was medium height, built like me, compact and boyish. Her head was turned away from us, towards the far wall, and all I could see in the dim light were short black curls and a slice of white, high round curve of the cheekbone, the point of a small chin. "Here," Frank said. He flicked on a tiny powerful torch and caught her face in a sharp little halo. For a second, I was confused. Sam lied. Because I knew her from somewhere. I'd seen that face a million times before. Then I took a step forward so I could get a proper look, and the whole world went silent, frozen. Darkness roaring in from the edges and only the girl's face blazing white at the center. Because it was me. The tilt of the nose, the wide sweep of the eyebrows, every tiniest curve and angle clear as ice. It was me. Blue-lipped and still, with shadows like dark bruises under my eyes. I couldn't feel my hands, my feet, couldn't feel myself breathing. For a second I thought I was floating, sliced off myself and wind currents carrying me away. "Know her?" Frank asked somewhere. "Any relation?" It was like going blind. My eyes couldn't take her in. She was impossible. A high fever hallucination. A scream and crack straight across all the laws of nature. I realized I was braced rigid on the balls of my feet, one hand halfway to my gun, every muscle ready to fight this dead girl to the death. "No," I said. My voice sounded wrong somewhere outside me. "Never seen her." "You adapted." Sam whipped his head around, startled, but the bluntness was good. It helped like a pinch. "No," I said. For an awful rocking instant, I actually wondered. But I've seen photos. My mother tired and smiling in a hospital bed, brand new me at her breast. "No." "Which soy do you look like?" "What?" It took me a second. I couldn't look away from the girl. I had to force myself to blink. No wonder Doherty and his ears had done a double take. "No. My mother's side, it's not that my father was running around and this is... No,
Frank shrugged. Worth a shot. They say everyone's got a double, somewhere, Sam said quietly, beside me. He was too close. It took me a second to realize that he was ready to catch me, just in case. I am not the fainting type. I bit down, hard and fast, on the inside of my lip. The jolt of pain cleared my head. Doesn't she have ID? I knew, from the tiny pause before either of them answered, that something was up. Shit, I thought with a new thump in my stomach. Identity theft. I wasn't too clear on how it worked exactly, but one glimpse of me and a creative streak, and presumably this girl could have been sharing my passport and buying BMWs in my credit. She had a student card on her, Frank said. Key ring in the left-hand pocket of her coat. Maglite in the right, wallet in the front right pocket of her jeans, 12 quid in change, an ATM card, couple of old receipts in this. He fished a clear plastic evidence bag out of a pile by the door and slapped it into my hand. It was a Trinity College ID, slick and digitized, not like the laminated bits of colored paper we used to have. The girl in the photo looked 10 years younger than the white sunken face in the corner. She was smiling my own smile up at me, and wearing a striped Baker Boy cap turned sideways. And for a second, my mind flailed wildly. But I never had a striped one of those, did I? When did I? I pretended to tilt the card to the light, reading the small print, so I could turn my shoulders to the others. Madison. Alexandra J. For a whirling instant, I understood completely. Frank and I had done this. We made Lexi Madison bone by bone and fiber by fiber. We baptized her, and for a few months we gave her a face and a body. And when we threw her away, she wanted more. She spent 4 years spinning herself back out of dark earth and night winds, and then she called us here to see what we had done. What the hell? I said, when I could breathe. When the uniforms called it in and ran her name through the computer, Frank said, taking back the bag. She came up flagged. Anything happens to this girl, call me ASAP. I never bothered taking her out of the system. I figured we might need her again, sooner or later. You never know. Yeah, I said. No kidding. I stared hard at the body and got a grip. This was no golem. This was a real, live, dead girl, oxymoron and all. Sam, I said. What have we got? Sam shot me a quick, searching glance. When he realized I wasn't about to swoon or scream or whatever he had had in mind, he nodded. He was starting to look a little more like himself. White female, he said. Mid-20s to early 30s. Single stab wound to the chest. Cooper says she died sometime around midnight, give or take an hour. He can't be more specific. Shock. Ambient temperature variations. Whether there was physical activity around the time of death, all the rest of it. Unlike most people, I get on well with Cooper, but I was glad I'd missed him. The tiny cottage felt too full, full of clumping feet and people shifting and eyes on me. Stabbed here? I asked. Sam shook his head. Hard to tell. We'll wait and see what the Bureau says, but all that rain last night got rid of a lot. You won't be finding footprints in the lane. A blood trail, nothing like that. For what it's worth, though, I'd say this isn't our primary crime scene. She was on her feet for at least a while after she got stabbed. See there? Blood's dripped straight down the leg of her jeans. Frank shifted the torch beam obligingly. And there's mud on both knees and a rip in one, like she was running and she fell. Looking for cover, I said. The image surged up at me like something from every forgotten nightmare. The lane twisting into the dark, and her running, feet slipping helplessly on pebbles, and her breath wild in her ears. I could feel Frank carefully standing back, saying nothing, watching. Could be, Sam said. Maybe the killer was coming after her, or she thought he was. She could have left a trail straight from his front door for all we'll ever know. It's long gone. I wanted to do something with my hands, rub them through my hair, over my mouth, something. I shoved them in my pockets to keep them still.
So, she got into shelter and collapsed. Not exactly. I'm thinking she died over there.
Sam pulled back the brambles and nodded at a corner of the outer room.
We've got what looks like a fair-sized pool of blood. No way to be sure exactly how much. We'll see if the Bureau can help there. But if there's still plenty left after a night like this, I'd say there was a load of it to start with. She was probably sitting up against that wall. Most of the blood is on the front of her top and on the lap and seat of her jeans. If she'd been lying down, it'd have seeped down her sides. See this?
He pointed to the girl's top, and the penny dropped with a bang.
Not tie-dye. She twisted up the top and pressed it against the wound, trying to stop the bleeding.
Huddled deep in that corner, rush of rain, blood seeping warm between her fingers.
So how'd she get over here? I asked. Our boy caught up with her in the end, Frank said. Or someone did anyway.
He leaned over, lifted one of the girl's feet by the shoelace. It sent a fast twitch down the back of my neck, him touching her, and tilted his torch at the heel of her runner, scuffed and brown, grained deep with dirt.
She was dragged, after death, because there's no pulling under the body. By the time she got over here, she wasn't bleeding anymore. The guy who found her swears he didn't touch, and I believe him. He looked like he was about to puke his guts up. No way he got closer than he had to. Anyway, she was moved not too long after she died. Cooper says rigor hadn't set in yet, and there's no secondary lividity. And she didn't spend much time out in that rain. She's barely damp. If she'd been in the open all night, she'd be drenched.
Slowly, as if my eyes were only just adjusting to the dim light, I realized that all the dark patches and stipples that I'd taken for shadows and rainwater were actually blood. It was everywhere, streaked across the floor, soaking the girl's jeans, crusting her hands wrist deep. I didn't want to look at her face, at anyone's face. I kept my eyes on her top and unfocused them so that the dark star swam and blurred. Got footprints?
Zip, Frank said. Not even hers. You'd think with all this dirt, but like Sam here said, the rain. All we've got in the other room is a shitload of mud, with prints matching the guy who called it in and his dog. That's one reason I wasn't too worried about walking you through there. Same thing out in the lane. And in here?
He moved the torch beam around the edges of the floor, nosed it into corners, wide, blank sweeps of dirt, way too smooth.
That's what it all looked like when we got here. Those prints you're seeing around the body. Those are us, and Cooper in the uniforms. Whoever moved her stuck around to tidy up after himself. There's a broken branch of gorse in the middle of the field. Probably came off that big bush by the door. I'm guessing he used it to sweep the floor clean as he left. We'll see if the Bureau pulls blood or prints off it. And to go with no footprints.
He handed me another evidence bag.
See anything wrong?
It was a wallet, white fake leather sewn with a butterfly and silver thread and swiped with faint traces of blood.
It's too clean, I said. You said this was in her front jeans pocket, and she bled out all over her lap? This should be covered with blood.
Bingo. The pocket's stiff with it, soaked through, but somehow this barely gets stained. The torch and keys are the same, not a drop of blood, just a few smudges.
Looks like our boy went through her pockets and then wiped her stuff clean before he put it back. We'll have the Bureau fingerprint everything that'll stay still long enough. But I wouldn't bet on getting anything useful. Someone was being very, very careful.
Any sign of sexual assault? I asked. Sam flinched.
I was way past that. Cooper won't say for sure till the post-mortem, but nothing on the preliminary points that way. We might get lucky and find some foreign blood on her.
A lot of stabbers cut themselves.
But, basically, I'm not holding my breath for DNA.
My first impression, the invisible killer leaving no trace, hadn't been far off. After a few months in murder, you can tell one of those cases a mile away. With the last clear corner of my mind, I reminded myself that no matter what it looked like, this one was not my